Anything that we did that we weren't directly paid for from the late 80s way up into the 2000s was a benefit. Like all of the cabaret and like solo concert work that I did, all of those proceeds went to Broadway Cares Equity Fights AIDS. In all of its iterations, at first it was Equity Fights AIDS, then it was Broadway Cares, then it was Broadway Cares Equity Fights AIDS. We'd work for free creating art and the proceeds going to these various organizations. So I guess it was just kind of built in, Carolyn. I mean, it's just what we did.
Greetings from Columbia, Maryland, on a beautiful spring day where we are recording Razzle Dazzle Radio, a show brought to you by Howard Community College. I'm Carolyn Kellerman, and I'm here with my co-host, Judy Templeton. Today's show will focus on volunteers.
We have two rock stars here today, Carolyn. Yay. And both of them have had so many contributions in the arts and beyond. And so I'm super honored to have Barbara Lawson and Rick Ryder here to talk to us about their illustrious careers and what they're going to be doing moving forward, because they're not going to stop. I'm positive of that. So let's meet Barbara first. And Barbara, you are one active lady. You have done so many things here in Howard County, quite an eclectic array, but always sort of segueing on social justice and arts promotion. I know that you have worked a lot in the nonprofit human services and presently with some disaster relief, refugee resettlement, and even financial and business consulting. And you serve on a lot of boards, to include the Women's Giving Circle, which you were one of the founders of. And presently, let's talk about, and then we'll go backwards of all these cool contributions that you have given to the county. But recently, I saw you get an award called Speaking Out, and it was for Visionary Women over at our own Columbia Arts Center. So tell us about that and what it meant to you.
Actually, to tell you about that, I think I need to give a little history. First of all, I was raised in a family where my aunt, who was a nun, supported her convent with the artwork that she did. Mm. And my mother would check out art from the library and hang it on our walls in our house. We lived in a small logging town. So I had some background and appreciation. My grandmother was a painter also, so that I had an appreciation, but I wasn't a painter. And I also came from a family that really was conscious of the wrongs in our society and tried to quietly do things about that. But my first real experience that struck my heart deeply was in Vietnam. I was involved in running recreation halls where guys could come in, and we had art rooms. And I soon learned that these young men and some of the women would go in the art rooms and they would either paint things, write poetry, do some sort of collage work or whatever, but it all had a meaning about what they were experiencing in Vietnam. So I asked actually if there was like pieces, like they'd walk away, it would just be left on the wall. Could I have some of it? And so to this day, I still have some of those pieces about the horrors of war. And you can tell it still chokes me up when I look at their work and what they were trying to express. And so over the years, then when I was working with Cuban refugees in the 80s, the Marielitos, like 120,000 Cubans were sent on a boat lift from Cuba. And I ran a refugee camp in Fort Smith, Arkansas. And again, the art, the culture is what bubbles up from different populations always. There has to be an expression from the heart. Huge pieces they were painting, like with Fidel Castro with fangs and, you know, the Cuban flag with blood on it. It was amazing the things that they were expressing from both their past and what they were experiencing being trapped in Fort Chaffee and waiting for resettlement for, you know, lengthy times. And so again, I was struck by that and started collecting their art, much of which I turned over to a university in Miami because I think it needs to be saved. And just over the years, I've had really wonderful experiences of having art demonstrated what it can speak to and convey to other people in a modality without necessarily words. I mean, it can be poetry, it can be music, it can be dance, it can be all of those things, but the visual arts are probably what struck me the most. So anyway, when I retired, and I worked on the visual arts committee at the Columbia Festival of the Arts, and when I retired, just always had an interest in how do you reclaim things that are thrown away? How can you make a statement about that? So now, current, I was invited if I wanted to put some pieces in the most recent show, Visionary Women Speaking Out, Speaking Up. So I took two pieces over to Liz, and she said, well, I'd like both of them. I thought she'd just pick one to put in. And I said, well, you know, in my heart, I've always wanted to see three together because I think it makes a stronger statement. So one of them speaks to racism. And it's made out of an old sconce that came off the building that I live in with a lighting sconce. And it has the Ku Klux Klan. Then there's another one. I'm very opposed to capital punishment. So using an old electrical piece and old leather watch bands, I was able to do a piece on capital punishment that they're not pleasant to look at and necessarily. And then the last one was called Blind in One Eye and Can't See Out of the Other. And in the totality, I feel like sometimes in our country, we are blind in both eyes. So anyway, there was a special award for speaking up. And I was chosen because I guess my pieces spoke to people in a way that I was really speaking up about those issues.
We always talk about on this show, the past, present, and future, and how it all intertwines. And so you clearly gave us your motivation. So is this something that you have worked on over the years so that you have always done this kind of art, or is this just suddenly bubbled up recently?
I've always had an interest in repurposing things. I lived for several years in England, and I love going out in the countryside and finding something that somebody else might find was just junk in an old barn and bringing it back and, you know, cleaning it up and sanding it, maybe varnish, you know, whatever, just reclaiming it. And I just started seeing how you could use things that you found for a metaphor for issues. And I'm not sure how that evolved. I mean, I don't know how your unconscious works, but I would just start having these things, and then I'd start playing with them. And then all of a sudden I'd say, this is a message. And it pleased me. For some reason, you know, when you look at, you put something together and it pleases you, I don't know how to explain that. I guess that's a payoff sometimes for doing the work.
Yes, absolutely. What was your career before you retired? And I would hardly call it a retirement because it sounds like you're busy as ever when you were working. So what was that career in?
I came out of the University of Washington as a social worker, but when I was with the military, I wasn't in the military, I was with Red Cross, but I was assigned to Fort Sill, Oklahoma, and I got my master's in public administration there. So I've always worked in the nonprofit sector. I find service is an important component for me and how we can make a difference in this world. And it's also, the nonprofit sector is important in creating community. And community is something that can heal divisions between people. And so I'd like to see my life kind of dedicated to how do you create that? So it's been the nonprofit sector, most of it. And then I've been lucky enough that I was interested in how finance impacted poor people. And so I did budget and finance counseling for a long time with people, kind of as a private piece. And that's led me in different places, and including getting to be on the Howard Bank board kind of in its formative years. So I've been a very blessed life. Lots of good things in my life.
And you've given lots of blessings too. So it definitely works well. So tell me about, because we like to talk about the arts, of course, here. So tell me about your work with the Howard County Arts Council.
Oh, well, I've been a huge fan. It was Mary Toth first and then Colleen West. And we are amazingly lucky to have Colleen West heading up the Howard County Arts Council and how she's grown the Arts Council. But she, some years ago, asked me if I would be on the Howie Committee. And somehow I've ended up being the chair for probably way too long. It's been a wonderful opportunity to stay in the arts and see all the different ways. I mean, you know, we have a Howie for educators. And that is a really tough one because you've got music educators and you've got visual arts educators, you've got dance educators, you've got all of these people that are very worthy. So that's one area. And then we have an artist category, and then we have supporters of the arts. I'm a big fan, and I like going to the shows. I think they do wonderful. Their galleries are fabulous. And what more can I say about the Howard County Arts Council? Yeah.
Well, we've got a Howie Award winner on our show right now, Carolyn. Well, thank you for all that you do. And now we even have a better understanding as to why you do it. I love the background that you were paying attention to, and it has led you to do so many great projects, all of a service origin. And just keep serving, Barbara. You do it so well.
Thank you.
So now, Rick. Okay. So are we talking to you from Manhattan, Rick? Are you up in Manhattan?
That's right.
In your cool Manhattan apartment. I love it. I'm getting a feel. I'm looking at it right now. Oh my gosh. So
yeah, I'm in Hell's Kitchen.
Oh, that's just wonderful. So Rick is originally has roots from Howard County, but has certainly spread his wings and done so much. He's done Broadway, and he has been all over, and we can't not speak about Rick where we don't give one quick shout out to his famous mother, Ann Ryder. And he's used to speaking to that as well. He has a private voice studio. I mean, there's just so many things. Your bio is just amazing. So let's talk about where it began and how you got to where you are right now, too.
First, I just wanted to say I'm a big repurposer. Barbara.
Oh, okay.
It's in my blood, domestically and artistically, you know, for like actual use and for artistic purposes, and vehemently, passionately against capital punishment. And I've been bringing music into prison since the early 90s. There was an organization called Hearts and Voices that was created to bring music, cabaret, into the AIDS wards here in New York in the hospitals that we could get into. And then there was the prison ward at St. Clair's Hospital, which no longer exists, right here in my neighborhood. And that was my first experience. And anyway, it was enlightening. So Northfield Elementary School, third grade, I did my first play. The director was Frank Lyman. It was a production of The Tortoise and the Hare. And I was playing both the tortoise and the hare. Ooh. In a reversible costume that my famous mother made. And that was the beginning. And I owe a lot to Northfield Elementary School. That's where I first sang in a chorus, played in the band. I was very active in the music program in my church, St. John's Episcopal Church on Frederick Road in Ellicott City. Maybe that was the first choir I was in. I'm not really sure if it was Northfield or there. Started to play the piano then, and it was all kind of born then. And then out into the county, Howard County Youth Operetta. I was in the first musical, the first year of Howard County Summer Theater, which still goes on that Bo Dunner created.
Yeah.
I was much, much too young to be in Guys and Dolls, but I was. And then we were talking about this before we started recording. There was an organization called the Baltimore Actors Theater in Baltimore. And it was a self-contained conservatory with a couple of in-residence theaters. They had a children's theater. They had what they called adult theater. But it was just there were musicals that played like five or six show weeks. And for community theater, it was really, really something. It was a full-time operation. And I was there for a couple of years. And then I met Toby Ornstein and was invited into the Young Columbians' second show, the Broadway Review. And I really actually started to work, to make some money at this, doing television commercials and PBS TV, local PBS TV, and like, you know, local modeling, you know, for like the department stores and stuff, for like the Saturday and Sunday papers. And then the Young Columbians, you know, was a job. You know, I bought my first car, you know, in the Young Columbians, and my second car. And it gave me, I guess, a sense of childhood autonomy and independence, gave me my own dough.
It gave you your wheels for sure.
Yeah.
Metaphorically as well, but anyway.
Yeah.
Well, that's a great story. I mean, it's always good to remember fondly those great days of Columbia. And of course, mm-hmm. We always shout out to all the contributions that Toby Orenstein has made. And yep, that was just, I think that was such a special time and a special group. It would be hard to see that happen in exactly in the way it happened then. Again, so
Correct.
lucky for you that you have that, you know, great memory. Okay, so now you got, so now you're getting a little fame here, a little fame, a little fortune in Howard County. And so then I guess you grew restless to kind of move on to the next step or whatever. So take us to that place.
You know, it's interesting. I always studied, you know, back then, if you wanted to study music, it was classically based. You know, you studied music classically, you studied voice classically, you studied classical piano. And so I was doing those things, and I went to UMBC, and that the year that I went to UMBC, 1979, when I started college, that's the year that Toby bought the Garland Dinner Theater and turned it into Toby's. And because you had asked me before the show if I had, you know, worked at the theater, and I haven't. That was the beginning of my college career, where I became a very serious music student and really kind of dove into that. And I knew that that 8-show-a-week schedule at Toby's, you know, wouldn't really, I knew what that was about because I had done it growing up. So I went to school for 5 years. I went on the 5-year plan and graduated, and I signed a contract with the Baltimore Symphony Orchestra because I thought that classical music was what I was going to do. And I wanted to be on the concert stage. And I quickly realized through that experience that it really wasn't for me. It wasn't a pathway that I didn't see a pathway. I didn't see a pathway for me that seemed viable. There were people much older than I that had no money and weren't working and were, you know, scraping together, you know, like odd jobs and stuff like that, just as an actor would in the musical theater. But I don't know, there was something about it that didn't appeal to me. And so I just kind of pivoted and started pursuing musical theater again. And I worked at a theme park in Nashville called Opryland. If you're going to work at a theme park, that was the one to work at because it was in Nashville, which is a right to work state, which so there are no unions there. And so the musicians that played all the live shows in the park were playing for like Barbara Mandrell and Willie Nelson and big, big country people. It was their day job. And so the quality was awesome. And I worked there all the time doing industrials and recording sessions. And it was just a great time. But Nashville was really not the place for me. And I moved on. I worked on a cruise ship. And then I finally moved to New York and, you know, began to audition for Equity Theater.
And you certainly did make a lot of the auditions. Because I'm reading all these plays here on your bio. You have had a most illustrious career, and a lot because you've just gotten yourself involved in just so many places. So I guess your beginnings where you learned that you could make money in the field. And so you kept up in your game in order to do so, because otherwise you could have been a starving artist. And, you know, that's another part of the piece that you weren't willing
to do. It's interesting when I look back, it's like it was an honest assessment of myself that I didn't really know that I was making. Like, my voice really isn't built for opera, and I was never interested in it. But there's a whole other piece of it, you know, on the concert stage. Like if you go to the Meyerhof, and there are, you know, it's a symphonic work, and there's 4 singers: the alto, tenor, bass, and soprano. And that's the kind of work I wanted to do. And as an art song, you know, recital singer, and there's just not a big living to be made in that. And I just didn't have enough interest in opera to learn, you know, more. It meant so much more school and learning language anyway. So it was an honest assessment, I think, of what I thought I could do.
Clearly.
Is really what I was doing.
Tell us about the Broadway world. Tell us about being a gypsy and auditioning for shows in New York.
Back in the day, it was so much easier then.
Really?
Because I'm a singing teacher. I've been singing teacher for 20 some years. I've been teaching what I do for over 20 years. That's really my vocation now. And so I teach, you know, my contemporaries, but the majority of the students that I teach are 20 somethings, you know, out of college. And it is really tough. The numbers are so high. Musical theater has become so popular. And colleges realized what a kind of a cash cow a musical theater program could be for their school. And, you know, it's facilitated so many more people going to school and studying musical theater and landing in New York. And the work has shrunk. And, you know, COVID did a number on that as well. And so just the opportunity to be seen is insurmountable, the odds.
I bet. And
that was not the case. I mean, you know, there was the pounding of the pavement, there was waiting in line, there was waiting all day and not being seen. There was all of that same stuff existed then, but not in the numbers that it is today. I just went to auditions. You know, I was very focused when I got here. I started auditioning right away. I didn't know it then, but I'm a kind of a pragmatic person. You know, you got to find a place to live. You got to find a job. And simultaneously, I'm circulating, you know, the auditions in the trade papers, you know, and starting to go to them. And then you have to learn how to, like, not be a responsible employee to, you know, side gigs, because that's not really what you're here for. And that's hard, you know what I mean? If you can't show up, or you got to leave early, or you got to lie about something to try to get out of it, you know. But I was very focused. And the first gig that I landed, that I accepted, actually, because it kind of happened quickly for me at first, was the workshop of my first Broadway show called Senator Joe. And I was simultaneously offered, I think it was called the Desert Song at Light Opera of Manhattan. They were going to offer me my union card. And this other Senator Joe was just in workshop, so there was no union involved. Anyway, that was my first gig. And we workshopped it on and off for a year. We took it out of town, brought it back, failed miserably on Broadway very quickly. And I auditioned for my second Broadway show like that week. So I was in two Broadway shows in the 88-89 season. And it wasn't always like that.
We just had, we had a guest from A Chorus Line on our last show, because Toby just did A Chorus Line, you know. But to speak to that show, I think that show is so still timely and real. Would you agree with the whole, I mean, did you have any of those kinds of experiences? Did you ever have a Zach that wanted to know more about you, or?
That was a great insight into the dance world, which I'm not a dancer.
Okay.
I had to dance on Broadway. I had to more move well on Broadway than to dance. And so that show, you know, was created by, what's interesting about that, I'm not going to answer your question right away, is that I would go on to work with some of the people who were in those workshops, in those dance studios with Michael Bennett.
Yep.
You know, and pieces of their story are part of the musical A Chorus Line, which was really fascinating, you know, when I would bump up against that. And that was mostly in my teaching career. I mostly met other teaching colleagues that were part of that. And so the dance community really is sort of unto itself. Yes, Carolyn, you're pointing at yourself.
I wanted to tell folks about, I saw you on Broadway in Blood Brothers, and you had the lead in that role, right?
I did.
I want to personally thank you for your efforts and your singing and your presence and your good, wonderful self in all of the AIDS benefits that we've done here in Howard County. Right from the beginning, you were ready to come. And since this show is about volunteering, this was not for any money. I wondered what inspired you to do that, and especially the last one with Kevin McDonough's tribute.
You know, one of the reasons, Barbara, I asked you what award you had won. My mom, shortly before she passed away, was bestowed the Audrey Robbins Humanitarian
Association
Award. And then posthumously, she was inducted into the Howard County Women's Hall of Fame, which I accepted on her behalf. So, you know, I was a kid growing up with a mother who was like this superstar volunteer and humanitarian, but none of that was like really registering. She was, you know, my mother, you know, was, you know, she was going to cook dinner. And so it gelled a lot more toward the end of her life and certainly in her afterlife. And so I guess I was around that, and anything that we did that we weren't directly paid for from the late 80s way up into the 2000s was a benefit. Like all of the cabaret and like solo concert work that I did, all of those proceeds went to Broadway Cares Equity Fights AIDS. In all of its iterations, at first it was Equity Fights AIDS, then it was Broadway Cares, then it was Broadway Cares Equity Fights AIDS. We work for free creating art and the proceeds going to these various organizations. So I guess it was just kind of built in, Carolyn. I mean, it's just what we did. And it was clearer to me that what you were doing was really pioneering. This wasn't New York City. It was Howard County, Maryland, which is not the most conservative place in the world. or the area or Maryland itself. You know, it's always been a little bit more live and let live, and it was a great place for me to grow up. And so, not surprising, you created a labor of love, and not surprising, we all, you know, gathered and did it. A little bit maybe naive and unaware of what we were really doing, because it was quite pioneering on your part too.
And you know, Rick, I have to say, we could keep talking because, oh my gosh, I just loved speaking with you and Barbara, and we're running out of time. But we have in Howard County for sure, what you said, superstar volunteers and humanitarians. You are one, Barbara is one, Carolyn is one, I am one. We all have that in common. And we all have done what we love, loved what we've done, and used it for service to others. And so it doesn't get any better than that. I mean, when you said about being blessed, that's what we all share for sure. Both of your careers are so interesting, how you paid attention to your past that led you into your presence. And I know that you're going to continue all the good work into your future. And so we have to go, but thank you to Dragon Podcast and Howard Community College for our continued partnership. Don't forget to check out our previous episodes at Razzle Dazzle with Carolyn and Judy. podbean.com. We're also on Spotify or wherever you listen to podcasts. So until next time, this is Judy Templeton, co-host Carolyn Kellerman, superstars, rock stars, Barbara Lawson and Rick Ryder. We love you both. It's Razzle Dazzle Radio.